Five, four, three, two, one.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of On the Range Podcast, Warhog Tactical and Kelly Defense. How's it going today, Rick?
Man, it's going great, Mark, as always. Just want to thank our great Americans tuning in or tuning in all over the world. Thank you for giving us your most precious commodity, your time to listen to what we got going on. It's going to be a great show, buddy.
Yeah, man. This episode is brought to you by Killcliff, good, clean energy, fueling the American dream. Go to killcliff.com and use promo code OTR for On the Range, OTR15. Save yourself some money and get yourself some badass clean energy, 150 milligrams of green tea caffeine. Yeah, man, we use it all the time. Again, use promo code and go check it out. Rick's sporting the Tasty Blood Orange, my go-to. Anyway, Rick, we got a great show today. Why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest?
Yeah, buddy. So we've got Mike Shelby. He's the CEO of Forward Observer. He's a former intelligence NCO, and pretty much his business puts out intel sit reps, for lack of better terms. But I will let Mike kind of give you a better rundown, so I'm not butchering his business. Mike, welcome to the show, and thank you for your service, brother.
Yeah, buddy.
Yeah. Well, thank you all for having me on, and thank you. Thank you too.
Yeah, buddy.
So, yes, Mike, just
go ahead.
Just give us a quick. No, I just saying, just give us a quick rundown as far as you, Forward Observer, kind of what your whole business is and stuff like that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so we at Forward Observer, we produce a daily intel brief, and we track a number of topics. Typically, we're most concerned with emergency preparedness. So we're looking at indicators of political, social, and economic, financial, and monetary instability, which we've had quite a bit of over the past several years. We've been incredibly busy. We track, you know, I would really love to talk with you all about low-intensity conflict, because I think that's a very good model to understand what's happening in the United States right now. And, you know, call it gray zone conflict or whatever. We're definitely seeing elements of that. And so we've been tracking a lot of the extremists, you know, radical and revolutionary groups that are here in the United States, and tracking what they're doing, really trying to put together the piece of the puzzle in terms of, you know, what they're doing now and what they're going to be doing in the future, what their end goals are. And then we track, I would, you know, call them maybe, you know, political extremists. Basically, the politicians, the government leaders, the unelected bureaucrats who are really working hard on this peaceful revolution that's happening in this country right now. And then, of course, we sift through hedge fund data. And, you know, today we're looking at food price outlooks from the USDA. And really, we try to give readers a perspective on exactly what's going on in the country, because you don't get this stuff from CNN or Fox News.
No.
So give us your two cents there, Mike. What do you think, you know, quick status of the country, what's going on, where you kind of see things going, what's your projections? And then, you know, you talked about preparedness, you know, any type of preparedness tips you think the viewers, listeners should be start leaning towards if they're not already doing.
The Foreign Affairs magazine, the February, March, 2000, it's either 2018 or 2019 issue, summed it up great. It's their whole issue was dedicated to a new nationalism. The whole issue was about old America versus new America. And, you know, old America is, you know, predominantly, you know, Christian or Judeo-Christian values, capitalist. And then you have new America, which is, you know, very heavily immigrant, very heavily, you know, socialist, or, you know, some flavor of anti-capitalist, or at least, you know, nanny state type socialism. And the whole thing was about how do we make a new American for future generations? And that is probably the absolute best paradigm to look at what the Cultural Revolution is doing right now. I don't think we're in a, I mean, you don't need me to tell you this, but the country's not in a good place right now. And when I look on the right, and there's a big focus on the grassroots right, on hard power, right? We're going out and buying guns and ammo. And you look at what the left is doing, and they're exercising soft power. They're building institutions. They're building mechanisms to inform and influence. and win what, you know, John Boyd or Bill Lind would call, you know, the mental and moral planes of this low intensity conflict. And I look at the right, and, you know, I don't want to get too preachy or political, but I just don't see any ability to really counter, by and large, there are exceptions, but the rule is the right's just not doing what they need to do to counter the narrative. And, you know, Ben Shapiro is famous for saying, you know, facts don't care about your feelings. Well, in today's society, feelings don't care about your facts. Mm-hmm. And we live in a post-truth society, you know, with this post-modernist society. And I think they're doing a very good job at prosecuting this cultural revolution. And I'm actually very concerned about the future of the country, as I know you are as well.
Yeah. So let me ask you a crazy question. How much of this, if you want to say new America that you're seeing, do you think is old Soviet inject that has finally just caught up? Or do you just think that's just a road, you know, America's decided to turn because of the political powers or whatever the case may be?
That's a great question. I want to go back to, you know, you remember the book and film Dr. Zhivago, right? So back during the Cold War, the agency seeded that into Soviet society. And there's a portion of that book that talks about how revolutions, talks about revolution in a very positive light. And I was reading a book on gray zone warfare, and the author started talking about that. And I said, wow, that's pretty interesting. I didn't realize that, I knew that type of subversion was taking place, but that book is incredibly subversive. And now I look at the ideas that are being propagated in the United States today. And actually, if we could just go to France real quick, the French are complaining. I don't know if you've seen it, but, you know, a bunch of French generals wrote this letter to French President Emmanuel Macron, basically saying, look, there's going to be a civil war in this country because we're losing the fight for France. And, you know, they have a massive refugee population. The French education minister said, look, we have to be on guard because these ideas are coming from the United States, are coming from U.S. college campuses. They're now infecting French society, you know, the, you know, anti-colonialism and, you know, CRT and all that type of rhetoric. And so it made me realize that this is not just the United States thing. This is a broader West thing. So to answer your question, are these the gray zone chickens coming home to roost from Russia now? Russia's kind of, you know, turning the tables and now injecting these subversive. Quite possibly, yes. It very well could. You know, we know Russia has done, you know, at least proved to have done on the unclassed side some, you know, fairly low level, you know, Facebook ads and stuff like that. But I think there's a very good case to be made that Russia, China, maybe other people are involved. I don't know. I'm not saying this is like some, you know, cabal like Russia and China teaming up against the United States to push these subversive ideas through college campuses. But I do think that's happening.
Well, you got to think, where else would it come from? Sorry, Mark, I know I cut you off, but I just want to inject this one point. You know, whenever it comes to socialism, it only can stem from a couple places, right? That's not in our American DNA. So to even start thinking like that, you got to go, it's got to get injected from somewhere. That's just, you know, Rick's two cents on it. Just kind of what's your thoughts?
Yeah, it just seems like, you know, the Cold War, and, you know, we've all heard and seen the documentaries and reports of American universities was the battleground, and how quickly, and they had a plan. They knew exactly how long it would take. And I think it actually took a little bit longer. Maybe this last decade has really seen the end result of that work. I think what you're trying to say, and correct me if I'm wrong, that this is not only in the American universities now, this is taken in probably the advent of social media and how easy it is to coordinate and speak with other folks who are like-minded.
Yeah, absolutely. They are exploiting our free and open society. You know, this is not the socialist first attempt to do this in the United States.
No.
You know, we go back to Comintern, creation of Communist Party USA back in the 1919, all throughout the 20s and 30s, there were revolutionary and radical anarchists and socialist movements. And the FBI went in there and they broke everything up, right? They got CPUSA guys on tax fraud. They basically, they just basically destroyed that organization, the Socialist Worker Parties, the Socialist Workers Party. It's very interesting. The FBI, they went to their homes where their families, you know, their parents, they went to their girlfriends or, you know, boyfriends, they went to their places of work and they say, do you know you're consorting with a socialist? And they, isolated, they ostracized them from society. And that's one way the FBI's, kind of their COINTELPRO dismantled a lot of the socialist and radical anarchist movements back in the 30s. And then, you know, you go back in the 60s and 70s, we don't really need to go into that. But this is the third iteration now of the socialists slash, you know, maybe the East trying to do this in the United States. So, yeah, I absolutely agree. I do agree that these ideas are being pushed from somewhere. Some of this stuff may be organic, but I definitely would, given what's going on geopolitically, I have a hard time believing that this is not at least facilitated at some level by foreign governments.
The reason why it's so in the face now is I think you hit a good point. I think some of it is organic. These young minds are starting to take this and run with it with just very little direction, whoever's pulling the puppet strings. You see it all over the place every day. Now, the American way isn't the American way. It's the American way is letting everybody else have it their way.
Right.
It's unbelievable.
Well, yeah.
I think another part too, Mark, is you got to think we're in this generational age that didn't grow up during the Cold War. Mm-hmm. So you got to think for us, I mean, we were very much injected part of that, you know, so there was still that anti-socialism, anti-communism sentiments here in the country where all of a sudden it seems like, all right, now that technically, if you want to say the Iron Curtain's fallen, you know, dismantlement of the Soviet Union, now all of a sudden people have totally forgot that. And if you were to ask most people, hey, tell me about the Cold War, they'd be like, probably don't even know what it was all about or how that happened. So, but it's really shocking when, especially the French, like you're talking about earlier, Mike, how the French are blaming us, going, well, it's coming from your university. It's just like, whoa, crazy that we've become, if you want to say the socialist hub, supposedly, getting the word out. So,
yeah, in America, unbelievable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mark, so you mentioned,
go ahead, buddy.
If I could, you mentioned social media and, you know, back in the 20s and 30s and 60s and 70s, there were gatekeepers, right? If you wanted to publish a book, you had to go through a publishing house. And if it wasn't a major one, your book probably wouldn't be very widely circulated. And now anybody with an idea, good, bad, or ugly, can get on social media and get a million retweets. And so, absolutely, social media has accelerated what's going on. Absolutely.
Well, but with that, Mike, I'm going to pause you, man. Only if you fit their narrative. Because if you're in that classic 2A preparedness, self-reliant, you're not getting nothing. You get zero traction. It just seems like when you have these radical ideas, and that's really the part that bothers me and has kind of enlightened my eyes. So when you look at especially the First Amendment and you're sitting there going, well, if you can squelch freedom of speech, man, the rest just kind of fall away because now I can't even voice my opinion. The problem is, you know, there's been no check, for lack of better terms, on social media. So yes, they've got Section 230 protection, but they act as editors. And it's like, no way, dude, it doesn't work that way. And of course, all the backside, we know they got their little toggle switches so they can make sure that you're not getting the reach or whatever the case may be.
Oh yeah.
So it's totally to me, that's the real battleground nowadays is if you want to look at it, these social platforms, because they can pump out whatever rubbish they want to, and it's all good. But if you're sitting there trying to do, you know, pro-America, pro-gun, pro-whatever, that goes against whatever their norms are, man, you're not getting nothing.
Hey, Mike, I know that you said you prepare, you know, these daily briefs or whatever. Do you do activity that anybody can go and view? Like, do you have a blog or a webpage that people can get current events and state of affairs and that kind of thing? Do you push that out or is it just client-based only?
Yeah, so we do run a subscription service.
Okay.
And so, yeah. And so it's $10 a month or $99 for the year for our early warning report. And, you know, and it's been kind of an all hazards. So, you know, we'll talk about weather. We have a portion called situational awareness, which kind of covers what's going on in politics. And this is not stuff that you're going to go home and watch on the news. You know, this is stuff that gets underreported. We go to primary sources and, you know, it's not incredibly derivative like you would see. And if I could, one reason why I started Ford Observer is because in the Patriot prepper community back in 2015, 2016, I just noticed there's so much bad information out there. People talking about things, and their frame of reference was like, you know, was very narrow. And I just said, look, hang on. I'm coming from a place, I know a couple things about what's going on overseas. And so I started, you know, writing it kind of a daily blog post, or, you know, weekly or daily blog post, and people really liked it. So I, you know, let's just go back to the Cultural Revolution. And I don't mean to engage in boomer speak here, but, you know, there's a lack of critical thinking, and people only, unfortunately, you should be able to be exposed to whatever you want to on the internet, right? You can get a PhD on YouTube, for crying out loud.
Right.
But with today's education system, you know, you're learning what they want you to learn. And that even goes for colleges too. And so I just saw a real need just to say, hang on, we don't need to freak out about everything. We don't need to, the end of the world's not happening tomorrow. Let's just take an even keeled approach. Let's look at the evidence, and let's look at this like an intelligence analyst would. And that's how Ford Observer came about.
I keep coming back to this. It's interesting to me that, you know, Rick brought up that point very early about the, you know, the Soviets model about how we were going to get Americans to basically implode on itself. And I think that's exactly what's going on. Could you shed some light on how do you think we got to this point where capitalism and the American way and all these other things aren't the model that we should be looking at? We should be looking at socialism. How did that start? Because that model was what, back in the late 50s, early 60s. I mean, we're in 2021. So all those folks would have been the target back then, would have been our parents. You know, I never heard any of that. So how is it now that everybody is talking this way?
So there's a really great book by Brian Burroughs called Days of Rage. And he goes in to the 1960s and 1970s and looks at the black radical separatist movements and Students for Democratic Society and, you know, the Marxist groups. And
yeah,
he goes into the KKK as well, about basically how the FBI took them down as well. And he makes a point that a lot of these guys, whether underground, not a lot of them were actually arrested, and even fewer of them went to prison. And what did these people do? Well, we know they became college professors. So yes, these colleges are ground zero for how these ideas start to emanate.
Never thought about that.
And then how much do you think, as far as, you know, because I know you mentioned, you know, social, but let's take it at a broader spectrum. You know, everyone sits there and wants to type into the Google machine is like the sole source of getting your information. And of course, Google's going to plug in what they want Google to know. How much do you think that plays in as well? Or do you think it's strictly at kind of the university level feeding those ideas there?
Well, I imagine it's Google. It's definitely employees at Google and employees at Twitter and employees at Facebook. And they can say they have whatever policies they want, but you know, we all know what an admin guy can do back in Twitter or whatever. So, you know, in terms of like shadow banning and stuff, we know that happens. And so, yeah, there absolutely is a part of this that they provide top cover for their ideas, and they suppress ideas that are counterfactual arguments against what the socialists are saying.
Counterfactual. Is that when you're targeting facts that they know are damaging to what they're trying to get across?
Yeah. So I'll give you a real world example. I noticed this back in like 2012 or so. This is the first time I actually kind of realized what was happening. I read a New York Times article that the Obama administration had doubled doubled renewable energy resources for the United States. They doubled it. And I started reading through that. It's like they doubled it from 1% to 2%. And yeah. So when I say counterfactual, I mean, let's provide some context to what that actually means, because we live in a headline society, and we see this every single day.
Yeah.
Counterfactual arguments means, look, there's another piece to this, and let's maybe fill that in and then make an assessment on the whole picture here.
So Mike, you're talking about, as far as the preparedness piece, what are you kind of doing as far as that goes?
I do have another company called Gray Zone Activity, and we do intelligence and security training. And so I teach a tactical intelligence course, and this is really built around emergencies, right? There's so much focus, and it's not coming from a bad place, but there's just so much focus on, and I'm not trying to step on your toes either, but there's a big focus on guns and ammo. And all I want to say is, look, let's also be aware of what's happening beyond our line of sight during an emergency. So let's get a police scanner and let's do some open source, open source collection. And, you know, let's try to figure out exactly what's happening, because if we can figure out what's happening now, then we could probably get a very good idea of what's going to happen in the future. And in terms of preparedness, if we can have accurate expectations of the future, now I know exactly what to be preparing for. And the first thing that I would advise anyone to do is simply do an area study. And it doesn't have to be, you know, this 200-page annex or whatever. You know, it's actually a fairly simple format. But what I want to encourage people to do is, if you think that you're going to go through an emergency, you know, start looking at your local human terrain and check out the physical terrain and identify the assets and liabilities that you have in your area. Identify the people that you're going to be able to work with to provide security during some catastrophic scenario. And then identify the people who, you know, might cause you some problems. Maybe they'll resort to criminality. And if we can do that, then we'll be able to anticipate future conditions. And when we can anticipate future conditions, I know exactly what to prepare for. And the fact of the matter is, we are always going to be limited on manpower and resources and time. And so we have to be ruthless in our ability to prioritize what we're preparing for. Because I think a lot of people in this country are preparing for the wrong things, unfortunately.
So as far as what? Could you like expound on that? Like, what do you think they're preparing in the wrong way?
They're not preparing. Okay. You know, there's hundreds of books on EMPs and stuff, right? And look, EMP is a real threat. Okay. Mm-hmm. It's very unlikely. What's more likely than having to live through an EMP is having to live through your country becoming a third world country. And what we should be preparing for is, how do you take a third world country and build it into a first world zone? Because in Mexico and lots of countries in South and Central America, they're very nice, safe places. There are first world zones in third world countries. And man, I want to get the preparedness community to wrap their minds around that. And it's like, it's very unlikely that you're going to be living through a prepper fiction novel, although they are entertaining. And I'm not saying you should not prepare for worst case scenario, but you know, if we look at a matrix, an impact likelihood matrix, we got to prepare for the highest likelihood, highest impact events first. And the highest likelihood is that the standard of living, the quality of life in the United States is going to degrade because they're debasing our currency. And I can talk about 5 or 6 examples of how that is absolutely ruinous to countries. How the Romans debased their currency. That's one of the things that led to the downfall of the Roman Empire. I do believe that we're living in the final phase of the American Empire. And I can talk a lot about that if you want, just historically. And so what we really should be preparing for is, how do we save what we have when everything around us is deteriorating? And unfortunately, I think that's exactly what's happening.
Don't you have to have a large group of people to buy into that though? Is that city council? Is that?
Yeah. So politics is I think electing a good sheriff. I mean, that is something you want to talk about preparedness.
Yeah.
You know, okay, having a constitutional sheriff is probably one of the best ways you can prepare for the future. Getting that guy elected.
Yeah. Go ahead, Rick. Sorry about that, buddy.
No. So you're kind of hitting on the same things that I was leaning at. Just so when you're looking at, in Mike's opinion, preparedness, we're not talking as far as our food and water provisions, all that other stuff. You're looking at a bigger aspect going, all right, you know, who is the sheriff that we elected? So are you actually being involved in the election process, and who's sitting kind of at the smaller municipalities is what I'm getting from you, than more so than at the larger federal government size. Is that kind of what I'm getting?
Yeah, everything's local. So what I look at it kind of like layer one solution is survival. You know, you got to have food and water, got to have means of defense. And then you have a second layer solution, which is kind of survivability. You know, how do you build a tribe? How do you build a community and spread a culture of preparedness? How do you network with your neighbors? Can you build a local neighborhood watch? Because you know what a local neighborhood watch is? A de facto intelligence network.
Yeah.
And so those are the kinds of things that I really wish the preparedness community would get more on board with, because those layer two solutions, you know, I mean, you can have a month's worth of food saved up and okay, great, you're going to eat for a month. But, you know, what about day 32? And if you don't have these layer two solutions, your survivability is greatly diminished.
So kind of looking at that, on that concept, I totally get what you're saying, you know, kind of the local hub's the way to go. But let's take an example, you know, unforeseen Colonial Pipeline, right? Who would think that that thing would have got hit by a ransomware attack? Did you happen to see anything during your intelligence analysis that led anything like that? I mean, I know our, you know, our power grid has been, you know, questioned in the past as far as, you know, how well it's secured, stuff like that. Was that something you saw and kind of predicted? Is that something that you think will continue? What's kind of your feedback on that stuff?
Yeah. So, you know, our report's called Early Warning, and we do our absolute best to talk about, and actually we very often we talk about things and 2 or 3 days later or a week later, you know, it pops up in the news somewhere or becomes a thing. Mm-hmm. I had no warning for that. You know, there's some things that I don't know if I had a $1 billion budget, you know, and sure, let's do it.
Sure.
But yeah. We've talked about ransomware, and, you know, we've talked about numerous times where ransomware, and actually before Colonial Pipeline, ransomware infected some computers in Washington, D.C. And they're talking about releasing there's a hack of some computers in Washington, D.C., the Metro Police, and they were threatening to release information on informants.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we have been talking about this stuff, but we can't predict, you know, we really can't predict that will happen other than somewhere it's going to happen.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You were talking about the currency, you know, attacking the value of the currency. Is that through alternative currencies like they're coming up with now, like the crypto and the Bitcoin or stuff? Or is it the traditional printing more money, devaluing the dollar, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, it's a little bit of both. JP Morgan did a study. They did a 600-year study on the lifespan of world reserve currencies. And what they found is they last from about, a currency has world reserve status for about 80 to 100 years. And so if we take Bretton Woods in 1944, maybe 45, it was 44, as the beginning of that 80 to 100 year lifespan for the US dollar as the world reserve, then we are coming up on that in the next 20 years. And so, you know, that's probably indicator number one. Okay, that's what originally piqued my interest. And then we have the Chinese developing this digital yuan. Okay, they have a digital currency now. And I don't think the Chinese, I think they're trying to erode, you know, I don't think they're in a position to completely replace the US dollar as the world reserve currency. They don't have capital markets that can facilitate that. And so what they want to do is slowly chip away at it. And now you look at Bitcoin, and some people are trying to push Bitcoin as a world reserve. And so what I think is very likely end up happening is, A, the United States dollar is already losing world reserve status. We know this. We can look at the percentage of U.S. dollars held in foreign reserves. Back in the 1990s, it was like something like 77% of all foreign reserves were U.S. dollars. And then, you know, that ticked down to 61% last year. It's down to 59% now. Okay. That's a trajectory. People are, as the dollar's value is being diminished, they're getting rid of it because they don't want to take their own currencies in the process. So they're, you know, eventually we're probably going to see central banks buying Bitcoin to add to their balance sheet, to make their currency stable. If you hold Bitcoin, it's great. But it's bad. I mean, it's bad. I mean, for the economy, if you hold dollars. If you hold dollars, it's going to be catastrophic.
Yeah.
I mean, you look at the Fed's balance sheet, right? $7.9 trillion. There's really no way that they can pare that down. I mean, how are they going to sell off trillions of dollars worth of assets? Who's buying trillions of dollars? The Fed is the lender. Yeah, that's right. No foreign country is going to do that. The Fed is the lender of last resort. And so we're stuck in a position where the Fed is going to be looking at $10 trillion in the face. Well, how many trillions of dollars does the Fed need to have on its balance sheet before foreign investors start to say, hey, you know what? Maybe the dollar is not that safe haven asset. You know, maybe instead of going 100% in the dollar during the next crisis, because we know the dollar traditionally has held value. That's why it's the world reserve. You know, maybe we'll go 60-40 into something else. Maybe we'll put in the digital you want. Maybe we'll buy Bitcoin. So long-term catastrophic for the dollar and holders of the dollar.
So what's kind of your prediction as far as, so from a preparedness standpoint, any take as far as that goes?
Yeah. One thing we're seeing, you know, right now with supply chain disruption causing inflation last year, they talked about meat shortages because all the food packing plants. Mm-hmm. One reason why I moved outside of Austin city limits is to be in the country and to be as self-sufficient as possible. Now, look, I don't have all the answers. Okay. All I can tell you is what I'm doing for myself personally. And I certainly am not a financial advisor and I don't pretend to be, and no one should use this as financial advice, but I will tell you what I'm doing. I'm diversifying out of the dollar into crypto. into land in a, you know, worst case scenario, you know, I will have a working homestead where I can live for I can survive for 2 to 3 years. You know, I have a local tribe here. We've built an awesome group with veterans. And if I could advise anyone to do one thing, it's to build a local tribe with veterans, with some former infantry guys, maybe a couple of medics, and I don't know, maybe an intel guy, you know, to and get together and start saying, hey, you know, maybe the worst case scenario won't happen, but if it does, you know, we could be okay for a couple of years, you know, if we had to.
On your crypto, and Mike's asking as far as gold and silver, I'll get to that in 1 second, Mike. But as far as crypto, are you worried about that in the sense of what happens if this almighty interweb gets compromised or whatever the case may be, and you've got no access to your crypto?
Yeah, there's going to be risks with everything. If I hear that all the time, right? People are very anti-crypto. They say, well, if the internet goes down, your bank account's going down too, right?
So sure. Depending how much you got sitting in there, I guess.
Yeah, right. But here's the thing. This is one reason why crypto is better than money in a bank. It's because if there's a bank holiday, you're not going to be able to go buy an ATM. If there's a bank holiday, you can still exchange your crypto as long as you have the internet or as long as you have a bridge to get out. And even now there's some cryptocurrencies that as long as you confirm that transaction on, you know, on six nodes, it's as good as gold. So maybe it'll take a few hours to, you know, to propagate along for the rest of the blockchain. And you know, and people talk about, oh, I'm going to go be an expat. I'm going to flee the United States. Well, good luck doing that with capital controls. You know, good luck wiring your life savings from a bank to Costa Rica.
Right.
You can't do that. And you're not going to, there's no way you can bring gold out of the country either. Not at the rate that you need to. Can you do that with cryptocurrency? Yeah. In about 15 seconds, you can.
So what's kind of your take then on gold and silver? You think that's a worthwhile or not?
Well, I look at gold and it's, you know, it's not a hedge against inflation. A lot of people say it is. You can look at the history. It's not. Mm-hmm. What gold is a store of value until you can get back in whatever local currency you're in. And so for a lot of people, gold will make sense. A lot of people talk about bartering silver. I don't have anything against gold and silver. I think people are right when they say, hey, you should diversify and have a little bit of gold and have a little bit of silver. I think that's fine. Just for me, it's not my number one safe haven asset.
Okay. Thanks for the question, Mike. Good thought on that. You know, I kind of want to switch gears a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about the border. You know, everybody kind of watches it and you get what the media puts out to. We kind of digest it. And you being in the intel biz, what in the world is the biggest problem coming out of that?
If we can agree that the state is losing legitimacy, and, you know, if we can just have a key assumption that the United States is in a final stage of, you know, its late stage empire, then traditionally what happens is you have a power vacuum. And so one concern that I would have is you look at these cartels, very wealthy, very well armed, very well organized. We know that on the border, I mean, here in Texas, they're moving the border north. They're forcing these ranchers to sell. They're intimidating them. They're coming in and buying these ranches. And, you know, now they've got another 12,000 acres to, you know, move up into the, you know, breathing room buffer zone, essentially. And so I actually do, I'm not the first person to talk about this, but I think Ed Calderon is great. He's talked about this, a couple other guys, the cartelification of the United States. You know, in the U.S., we have growing populations of, and this is not a, I don't want anyone to take this the wrong way, but we do have growing populations of Guatemalans and Hondurans and El Salvadorans. And what do you find in those communities in many cases? Cartels or links to MS-13. And so if we do, you know, if a worst case scenario does happen, or if kind of the worst view is confirmed that, the country does start to, I don't even want to use the word collapse, but if we do have a power vacuum or some kind of empire collapse, you know, what's the likelihood that in some areas of the United States, these organizations are going to be able to take over just like they have in Mexico and Central America? And I would say in a lot of places, pretty darn good odds.
Yeah.
You know, you look at how in Mexico, especially, I pay a lot of attention to Mexico, how these cartels and how they've paid off politicians and they've paid off sheriffs. And, oh, you're a cop and you don't make any money? Well, you know, here you go. Now you can live a nice middle-class lifestyle, you know, if you just, you know, ignore what the cartel's doing here. And in some places, the cartel has even become the de facto government. And so that's probably my number one fear for the United States in terms of what's coming across the border right now is sympathetic potentially sympathetic populace.
And I think here's the thing too with the southern border is we don't know what's coming across. I mean, we can make the assumption, you know, it is individuals from Central and South America, but again, that's an assumption. Who else is getting in those lines and bringing up, and what are they bringing in? You know?
Oh yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to imply that it's just Central and South Americans. I mean, it's Chinese, Afghans. I mean, you know, it's everybody, sure. All nationalities coming across the southern border.
Yeah. And I think that's the scary thing is not knowing who, what, or what's rolling across. Okay, cool. Now that you're in, now what are you doing? How are you, you know, you don't know what's already been established as far as networks already set up here, what's going on. So your advice on that?
Tribe. I mean, you have to build local, I use the word institutions, but you know, we kind of have to go back to the old ways of doing things, being a member of a community, become a member of a church, because that's a great place because community is already built around the church. And, you know, if you can get community buy-in, you know, if people at a local church kind of feel the same way you do, then now that's that's kind of forced multiplication, right? If I can inform and influence 50 people at my local church, now all of a sudden I've just 50x our ability to build community around this potential scenarios.
And I think Brad brings up a good point too, talking as far as, you know, Portland and other places where the whole defunding the police and left a huge power vacuum. I mean, seems to me like a spot to go to, if you want to say safe haven or fire things back up, however you want to look at it.
You know, that's a good point about the issues up in some of those states. Have you done any work on that? How that all kind of started and why is it continuing to go? Is that just simply because the local politicians are allowing it? I mean, how has that continued to keep its momentum for that long?
Yeah, we have tracked a lot of those groups very closely. A lot of this stuff goes back to the Battle of Seattle, and was it 99 or 2000, right? That you had the G7. And that, you know, that was kind of the first time, I think, when I call them Americans, but I use that term very loosely, when Americans kind of realized, like, hey, we're actually building a movement here, and we're and it's just proliferated from there, mainly on college campuses. You know, you look at what the Trump administration tried to do last year, right? With these 120 to 150 days of riots in Portland. And what did they do? They sent in BORTAC. They sent in, I don't remember, Marshal Service. They sent in federal law enforcement, and they started grabbing these dudes off the street, throw them in a minivan, and take them to the detention facility or the police station or wherever they're going. And we live in a place where all that stuff gets recorded and put on social media. And then what did you see right after that? Now you start seeing the moms get out there. And the moms, the Portland moms, they weren't pro-Antifa, but they did not want to see federal law enforcement come into Portland. It's just like this massive counterinsurgency effort, error, like no one has learned anything over the past 20 years. And so I think they actually inflamed the situation. One thing we're seeing now is a lot of that sentiment a lot of the momentum has slowed. And so for Antifa in Portland, now the question is, how do you keep that momentum going? And they have kept it going. They're still trying to burn down the courthouse a few nights a week. You know, they're still fighting with cops. But, you know, instead of hundreds of people being out there last year, you know, I mean, we track Max. Max is one of my analysts. He tracks the numbers, you know, and it's like 10, 20, 40, you know, 50, not 100. So obviously that momentum is slowing down. And the question that we've been trying to answer is, what's next? How do they keep that momentum up?
Let me ask you this. In your experience and in all the stuff that you've put together when it comes to those type of organizations up in Portland, and where do you think that funding's coming from?
Okay. So yeah, I have, you know, obviously I'm looking for signs of external support. I look at their gear. Number one, you look at the armed leftist groups and you look at their gear, and you know, 3 or 4 years ago, 2016, when I first started tracking this stuff, you know, they had, you know, granddad's shotgun and maybe a bolt action rifle they picked up from the pawn store. And in the past year or two, now we're talking about AR-15s and plate carriers, and you can look at their kit and it is set up properly. And we know they're veterans, and there's actually soft dudes now who are involved in this stuff. And they've had people over in Kurdistan and in Syria fighting against the Islamic State. And so they're bringing that operational knowledge back. I mean, we're talking about dudes with like some pretty serious, you know, combat bona fides who are maybe prior service Army, Marine Corps, maybe not, but you know, they've learned, if nothing else, they've learned from the Kurds in the fight against the Islamic State. So is that indicative of external support? I would say no. I think a lot of that stuff is self-funded. That's my own personal take. However, there is a very good chance that they do receive funding. If you look at the relationship between, you know, Sinn Féin and the IRA, and, you know, let's go back to Iraq, right? You look at Iskie Botter or Jaish al-Mahdi and the Sadr movement, right? Political party plus militant wing. And so what are we saying? You know, Democratic Socialists of America, the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and political parties hand in hand with militant wings. And I think that's very, I think that's how the militant wings are being funded, is through the political parties or the political wings of these movements.
Yeah. So one thing, Mike, it going on that same kind of thought process here. So Boris is asking, as far as, can't help but suspect that Communist China would employ the cartels. You think there's, what do you think that tie is?
Yeah, so the Army, and actually I would love to send this to you. The Army published a report back in December 2020 where they said, and actually this goes back to the National Defense Strategy in 2018. They said, look, in the next conflict against a near peer adversary like Russia or China, the information, it's not just the information and communications space that's going to be disrupted. It's also, let's say, the 2018 National Defense Strategy says, expect expect CONUS to be a contested environment. And this Army paper in December 2020 says, expect protests, expect the use of criminality. Okay, this is hybrid warfare. And so, you know, if you're China, and let's just say in the next 2 to 3, 5, 6 years, 10 years, how many years ever, we were to get into kind of a high-end conventional conflict, well, you have to stop the mobilization of the U.S. war machine from getting over there. And how do you do that? I don't know. Terrorism in Navy port towns, blocking,
right?
Targeting families. And actually targeting families was in that December 2020 report. So the Army is saying, prepare for hybrid warfare, because someone is going to use it once we get into a war with them. And so what's the potential for China to use the cartel? Maybe. We know that the cartels are protecting illegal Chinese mining operations in Mexico. We're not going out on a limb to say that could quickly turn into, maybe Chinese funding cartels to carry out, you know, criminal or acts of sabotage or kind of unconventional warfare type things inside the United States. So I think that's a completely realistic scenario.
Great question there, Boris. Well, I tell you one thing, let us put you on speed dial. If something ever comes up again where we need your expertise,
you come. Oh, man.
Man, help us figure out some of this stuff and maybe explain a lot of it. You know, I consider myself a guy of average intelligence, and some of this stuff can get kind of convoluted, especially with the money. And yeah, there's a lot going on, especially with not just the southern border, all borders really. So where can folks get a hold of you, reach out to you, subscribe to your public stuff?
Yeah. So my website is forwardobserver.com. And if you click on the subscribe button, you can see kind of what we talk about, what you can expect from the report. It's just at Gray Zone Warlord, Gray with an A, Gray Zone okay. Warlord. And, you know, they say LinkedIn is a place you go to find a job, and Twitter is a place you got to lose a job or something. You know, so, yeah.
Well, you know.
Does Ford Observers have anything, or is it all just, run?
Yeah, we do have a YouTube channel, too. It's just okay. Ford Observer.
You know, that's I can't imagine why you would not be popular and have a good following, but I can imagine how you might run into some issues here and there. Can you talk about that a little bit?
And my,
well, I'm more talking about the social media platforms. How are they treating you these days?
You know, I had like a decent following built up on Twitter, and then they went and did that big purge, and like I just lose followers all the time. I don't know if people are just like getting tired of my, can I say shit posting or not? But, or if it's, I don't know.
Yeah.
It's the backside. So again, you know, you talked earlier before, as far as the shadow banning, stuff like that. Again, if you're in that preparedness to a, you know, section, whatever the magic button is they're pressing or toggle switch or whatever they're doing, trust me, they're controlling exactly how much you get. So you can't tell me that in a day, 10 people sit there and follow my page, and then magically those 10 people have what, followers regret and bail? Come on, right. And I'm on the low end. I mean, there's people out there losing thousands a day because of what they're putting out. So the problem is with all that social, you take it for what it's worth, right? You go out there, you put your stuff. To me, I'm a firm believer, get people to, you know, I don't know if you've got a newsletter you put out or anything like that, but people's emails, if you want to send me your, you know, your email address, that's a personal connection. Yep, you're going to get, you know, newsletter, stuff like that. To me, I control that. All the rest of the social stuff, it's just people do whatever they want.
Oh, no, yeah. And on that point, yeah, if you go to forwardobserver.com/dispatch, that's actually a good point. You can get on our email list. But yeah, okay. That's, you know, that's the double-edged sword of social media. If they get tired of you, just, you know, you're gone. That's it. YouTube channel.
Click the button.
Bye-bye.
Yeah.
But anyway, if you're down in the San Antonio area, Mike Green of Green Ops is down there. If you're looking for some firearms training, you know, they'll definitely good guy to chat with and get you hooked up on that.
Yeah,
one.
We had Mike on the show. He was great.
Yep. Yeah.
Had a little trouble with his set. Couldn't get that all lined up. That was great. If you guys didn't see that episode, go check that out. Mike's a great dude, yeah. Man. Great guy.
Yeah. So he's down there in San Antonio. So
yeah, buddy.
Might be worth a trip.
Sure.
And then the other thing I got for you too, Mike, I see you sporting a Fieldcraft hat. So are you tied in with Mike and Fieldcraft as well?
No, I'm not like tied into them. I was on one of their podcasts that they did.
Oh, okay.
I'm just a fan of Fieldcraft. I like their message. And, you know, it's like that layer two. You know, the Fieldcraft mobility stuff is great because these guys got 70-pound, not Fieldcraft, but, you know, the people build these 70-pound bug-out bags and they haven't checked their oil in 6 months, you know. So it's like, you know, or the tire tread. So
yeah,
I look at Fieldcraft and like layer two solutions.
Hey, man, thank you for all you do and all your service and just a great show. But like I said, we're going to have you on speed dial. Next time we have an intel question, we're going to bring you back on if you don't mind coming back on. But great, great stuff, buddy, and really appreciate you coming on today. Very informative.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. I really enjoyed it. And yeah, no problem. I'll give you my cell. No problem. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, buddy. Hey, don't just hang on. We're going to get back to you. We're just going to close this out. All right, buddy?
Okay. All right.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Man, what a good show. A lot of information.
Yeah.
Definitely have to get back.
Oh, 100%. A lot of interaction for the viewers, listeners out there. And guys, don't forget, please do us a big favor. Hit that subscribe button on whatever platform you're listening to us at. Leave us a rating, some type of review. I don't care if it's just a thumbs up emoji. So again, kind of talk back to this whole social platform. Just help us try to get the On the Range podcast out there because unfortunately, that's what they go off of is subscribes, likes, comments. So appreciate all your support, guys. And again, appreciate your time for tuning in.
Yeah. Don't forget, everybody, killcliff.com. Use promo code OTR15 and combat flip flops, promo code OTR25. Save 25% on that site. They got a bunch of good stuff going on. And all these companies that we have on here, they definitely do stuff and outreach outside of their own business and help a lot of folks out. So great show today, Rick. Big thanks to Mike Shelby. And don't forget to check out our Patreon page, guys. Go to patreon.com/onTheRangePodcast. All right, Rick, another one in the books, pal.
You know it, buddy.
All right, buddy. Have a good one. Be safe, everybody. And again, thank you for making us part of your day today.
Be my Frankenstein.